Hello, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, the Heart Guy, welcoming you to an exciting and informative podcast titled The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter, bringing you interesting discussions and conversations related to the vast and important subject of heart disease and heart failure and everything related to that in today's ever-changing world. I'm extremely honored to have as my special guest today an inspiring nurse in the medical and global communities, Doreen Brevda. Doreen graduated from the College of Mount St. Vincent and started her nursing career 34 years ago at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia, in the neurological step-down unit. She then transitioned into a cardiothoracic ICU with a clinical nurse one position and obtained her CCRN and then was promoted to the assistant head nurse after only 18 months. Doreen has worked in various roles in ICU, PACU, ASU, and adult and pediatric cardiac cath labs. She was then recruited by senior leadership to fill a new donor call heart TC position, which has evolved over the last 15 years of Doreen's career as a nurse, culminating as the senior heart transplant coordinator. Doreen, welcome to the Heart of the Matter.
Hi, Gary. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. This is going to be so interesting. I don't know a lot about this stuff, so I'm going to be learning along with everybody else. I need to know what donor call is and all this, but I figure we start from the beginning. So I'm going to get into it a little bit right away because there's so much, Doreen, that I know that you have to offer everybody. So I'm waiting for the call to go to the hospital for a heart transplant, and that is the issue for me right now. How should I be best prepared for that call?
Well, the best thing to do, everybody gets excited. When the phone call comes, you have to take a deep breath when you answer it, but your phone has to be charged. And usually it's a phone call in the middle of the night because that's when most transplants happen. The OR is usually available and there's a lot more, you know, open OR time.
Wow, that's interesting. And so that happens just because the OR is empty at that time and they try and make it work that way? Or is that because people die in the middle of the night? I mean, how is that?
No, the donors are always declared brain dead. But then you also need to organize on the organ procurement side. That coordinator needs to get all the different transplant coordinator teams, all the different recipient surgeons to the OR. And a lot of coordinating happens, and usually it takes several hours to get everybody on the same page. And when they get to the OR, and usually most regular cases are finished for the day and they have more downtime in the middle of the night. And that's why most transplant phone calls are also happen in the middle of the night.
Oh my God. I'm usually up in the middle of the night anyway, thinking about everything that I've gone through during the day. So it could work for me. I'm glad to know it ahead of time anyway. So my cell phone is charged and I have my game plan. I got a little bag that I'm bringing. I guess I don't need too much because I'm going to be in the Johnny before I know it, waiting for it to be brought into the operating room. Have you ever had a situation where the prospective recipient, the patient, did not answer their phone?
Yeah. Unfortunately, one of my patients didn't have the phone charged that night. And actually, the phone was in the other room and he didn't hear it. And I actually had the police come and do a well check on my patient. And that's how we got him to come into the hospital. Because of all the organs that are transplanted, heart has the tightest time constraint. We only have 4 hours to get the heart back, but we need to get you into the hospital, get you all set to go, and then have the team go out and make sure the heart looks good. And we only have a couple, you know, 3 or 4 hours to get that heart back. It's a lot more time sensitive than like a kidney, which can go on a special pump and get FedExed across the country. So It's a different organ altogether.
Yeah. And I guess I'll ask you more about the donor situation with regard to organs in a little while. But so the parameters for hearts are different than for kidneys for that reason. The heart can only stay on ice, if you will, for 4 hours.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. We usually travel about 3 hours, and then the extra hour is the surgeon, the recipient surgeon, or your surgeon putting the heart in. It takes about an hour to sew it in. So we only have 3 hours to actually get back from the donor hospital, and usually involves a plane plus minus an ambulance or a special organ transport van. Because when we take out of Columbia, they take a plane out of Teterboro because we don't have a helipad at Columbia.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so interesting. Yeah, most people don't realize it. It really happens that way. And so many decisions have to be made during that time period too, because the heart is not, even though the blood type and the antibody profile and the size has all been matched, until that doctor on the heart transplant team has gone and actually examined the heart in person, that they don't check off that last box until they're happy with the way that that heart appears in the deceased. So the operation is not done really until it's actually done.
Yeah, that's right, Gary. We don't say 100% yes, we're moving forward until the surgeon goes to the donor hospital and actually visualizes the heart, palpates the heart, and that's when we're go, and that's when we would put the recipient to sleep and move forward. And a lot of the recipients have LVAD, so that also factors into the time frame for the recipient family members, like wondering why is everything taking so long. One other interesting thing was the last vehicle across the George Washington Bridge on 9/11 was an organ, a heart.
Wow, that's a little known trivia. That's great. Wow. That was a lucky person, right?
Very after lucky, that, and the heart's doing well.
Yeah. There's a lot of this that is out of our control. So, you know, we can only hope for the best. The waiting period is stressful for that reason, because there's so much that we don't know and so much unpredictability in this whole process. Besides the stress of actually having that operation done, which in and of itself is stressful enough, there are so many different other factors. So interesting. What do I need to bring? After all, I'll not need clothes for a while, I suppose. So what does a patient need to bring with them, if anything, when they come to the hospital for a transplant?
Yeah, well, after we hang up from you on the, from the phone, we'll make sure we have the correct phone number for you so that we can track you on the way in. And then to bring to the hospital, you should bring a list of any allergies that you have and your medications so you can review it with the transplant coordinator as well as the admission hospital staff. It'll make it a little bit smoother. Don't bring anything with, any kind of value, just your ID and your insurance card. Mm-hmm. And then you move forward from there because they're going to give you a gown and all that kind of stuff. You're going to be in the ICU for several days and then the hospital about 14 days on the step-down unit. Maybe a week to 14 days.
Yeah, if you're lucky. I mean, if they don't have to keep your chest open and other things they might have to do in recovery, depending on how things go, after the operation is over. So the operation is one thing, but then there's the aftercare, and that's a whole nother level of patient care that is very important to the process.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm admitted. So what might I go through once I'm admitted? They're going to just have me assigned to a room, I guess, where I wait until I'm brought into the operating room, right?
Yeah. A lot of times you'll be admitted up until the ICU. And then it's kind of a hurry up and wait kind of process. You'll have the doctors and the nurses giving you all your instructions, going reviewing your medications and your allergies, putting in an intravenous lines, and then also having you sign off on any kind of consent form for the surgery itself. One other factor, I don't want you to be concerned, but sometimes we would ask you before you even come in because of the time sensitivity. There are donors called increased risk donors, and there could be a variety of reasons why they're increased risk, but we would have to disclose that to you.
Yes.
And that would have to be part of the consent process. And we would make sure that there's no HIV or hepatitis B or C.
Right.
Just like we screen you guys during your evaluation period, we do the same thing on the donor side.
Yeah. And so everybody knows, I was going to say, Doreen, I've already signed off as a recipient that will accept a marginal donor in this part of the country, at least. In this part of the country, that's a person who has had hepatitis C. It might have been a person who used drugs. But what they can do now is transplant the hepatitis C heart into the recipient and then heal the hepatitis C over a number of months after the heart's been transplanted. It's quite extraordinary. So the way to increase the number of donors available, the donor pool, is by including people who have had hepatitis C as being acceptable donors. And this is one of the ways that we've tried to increase the donor pool. There's other factors. We've lowered, I think we've increased the age of acceptable donors to from 52 to 55. Maybe you know about that better than me. I don't know if my numbers are right. Certain cancers,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And certain cancers, I think, that didn't used to be acceptable now are. Am I on the right track there?
Yeah. Every center has their own criteria, but we usually take donors. We put in the filter in UNOS, the people who are in charge of the national waiting list, United Network for Organ Sharing, we put up to 60 years old, but we usually don't take donors over like 55 to, you know, between 55 to 60, but we always check the heart function and everything first. It also depends. There's a lot of factors. We looked at the patient's, the donor's history of hypertension, any kind of stroke history, you know, if they were on any medications, yeah. If they had, you know, any troponins or any kind of labs that reflect possible heart attack or anything like that. Like, we look at all of those different criteria for older age donors.
I think for a while they weren't accepting women's hearts, right? They were only using male hearts, and now they are using women's hearts.
Yeah. Well, we also we check the pressures of the hearts, the lungs. A male can get a female heart, but it depends on their heart pressures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another determination as part of the whole matching criteria.
Wow. Yeah. So interesting. So can my wife come with me now in the face of COVID-19? Do I have to go in there alone, or are they allowing now relatives to go in to the hospitals as far as you know? I know you haven't been in the hospital for a little while now.
Yeah. Well, it changes day to day, but now it seems like the visitation policies are opening up, and you definitely don't want to drive into the hospital by yourself. You want to have somebody go with you or drive you mm-hmm. in. And most people like yourself have an LVAD, so you want to bring your batteries and stuff with you as well.
Yeah.
But as far as visitation, you probably could have one person with you into the room and wait for you, because it's kind of a hurry up and wait thing where you're, you know, you had an EKG, you get an X-ray, you get some blood work, and then, you know, we will also take some extra serology tests for hepatitis B, C, HIV, if you have an increased risk donor, and we'll take that at intervals and check you a little bit more closely if that's the case. And then it's kind of, we have to be ready to go, but then you kind of, everything slows down and you have to wait for the donor visualization of the heart. And then once they visualize and everything's a go, then we move forward.
Yeah.
But there are other cases that are called dry runs, where you come in and then unfortunately either the donor status changes, or by the time they get to the heart and they see everything, things can get canceled. So there may be a reason why you come in, go through everything, be ready, and then for some reason it was canceled.
Yeah, and thank you, because that was actually my next question, was some of the reasons why the operation might get canceled. Yeah, and in my case, I had two aborted transplants. The first one, though, was when they examined the heart. They didn't like the quality of it, and so they canceled it for that reason the first time. And the mm-hmm. second reason, I had an unusual thing happen, which is just they had a good heart, ready for me. And right before the operation, they use a transesophageal echocardiogram to make sure that everything is clear, I guess, for, you know, in my chest to receive the heart. And they found a tear in my descending aorta. And they had to bring somebody, a specialist, to repair that. So when I woke up, I was back on the ECMO machine again, and I did not get my heart a second time. So third time's a charm, they say. I'm going to be going back in there in the next few months. So it could be tonight, late tonight, as Doreen has suggested. It could be in the middle of the night tonight, or it could be anytime in the next few months. I'm hoping to get a call. And so we'll see, but I'll be ready in the middle of the night. But yeah, these things are not definite. And that lends to the stress that a lot of caregivers really have to have on their shoulders, more so even than the patient, which we're trying to find ways to support the caregivers in different ways now, come up with ways, because the emotional stress on the caregivers, physical and emotional, is very great. And there's not a lot of systems set up for caregivers right now, but we're trying to figure out ways to do that. It's for another show, I think.
No, we also try and, you know, give the caregivers like updates as much as possible when you do go to the OR, because it can take up to 6 to 8 hours, but it could be even longer if you have an LVAD that needs to come out, or there's some issue with the heart getting back for some reason. We've had planes break. We've had different OR delays, like a trauma bumping an OR on the other side. So there's different reasons why there, and it's not all actual surgery time, but sometimes there are delays. So I don't want them to be concerned. We always talk to our family as they're waiting.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's scary when you think an operation is supposed to end and nobody's coming down the hall to tell you that it's over, or even worse, as it happened to me, where my surgeon walked down the hall after 2.5 hours when my wife was waiting, knowing the operation should have taken 8 hours. And imagining the worst. In my case, it got canceled. And then, you know, he had to also tell her about the operation that I needed to repair the aorta, which was not a good message either. Both times, meaning I wasn't going to get the heart that we had hoped for. So it's quite a an up and down roller coaster kind of experience for the families. And, you know, everybody, we know that all of the doctors and nurses and everybody involved in this process is trying to save lives. And we have to realize that in the big picture. And I do. And I hope everybody else does as well. But it's tough to go through when you're the patient and the relatives of the patient. So
Definitely. There's also a lot of behind the scenes items that happen that nobody really knows about. So, you know, we try our best to keep you informed, but we can't tell you every little detail, obviously, for different confidentiality issues. Also, you can be admitted for a primary heart, meaning that heart's just for you, or you can be a backup to a patient who needs a cross match ahead of you. So that's another reason why you're.
Oh my! So many variables. Crazy. So I survived the surgery. What are my post-op expectations? How long, again, you mentioned before, how long am I going to be in the CT intensive care unit?
You'd be in the cardiothoracic ICU about 2 to 3 days. Hopefully, if everything goes well, we'll get you up and out of bed in the next morning and try and get things out as soon as we possibly can for infection reasons. And then you go to step down between 8 and 11 days after. But you're going to wake up in the ICU. You're going to have a breathing tube called an endotracheal tube in your mouth. And you won't be able to speak when you wake up. But the nurses in the CT ICU, obviously a little biased because those were my staff when I was in charge. But those nurses are amazing. If we have to write things to each other, but we're very good at taking care of your pain. And we have to make sure that your anesthesia is wearing off. Once everything starts wearing off and you wake up, you have to take some deep breaths. And then there's a special line in the artery of your arm where we take blood to check how well your breathing and oxygenation is. And as soon as everything looks good, the first thing to come out is the tube in your mouth. And then you'll be able to speak. Your throat will be sore. And then you'll have an incision down the middle of your chest, and you'll have tubes that have blood in them. They're called chest tubes, draining from the operative site. And within a day or so, hopefully, those tubes will be coming out. And you'll also have an IV in your neck and a catheter called the Swan-Ganz catheter to measure your heart and your lung pressures. And that will come out in a day or so. And it helps the doctors just to alter your medications to make your heart's function to the best of its ability.
Having been up there as a patient, of course, several times at this point, I have gone through those types of operations and had to recover from them. But also, I, as a ambassador for Abbott and for American Heart Association, I've been fortunate to go up there and visit with patients who are either waiting for their operations or have survived them. And it's interesting to know that the things that they complain most about, that most patients complain most about, is the discomfort of a particular tube that they have, mm-hmm. or something that's just uncomfortable. When you look at it from the point of view that the doctors need that in order to allow the patients to function better, they need you to have those tubes in there. And then also they're saving your lives. It seems trivial, but it's not a comfortable time, in general, together with the fear and anxiety, you're actually very uncomfortable physically. So it's a very trying time for patients and their caregivers, because nobody's in a good mood up there as far as that goes. The only ones who are in a good mood are the nurses, thankfully. They have such a positive, wonderful attitude. No matter what you do and say, the nurses, for the most part, keep a very even keel. So, they've forgiven me mostly for some of the things I've said and done as patient. But when you have a lot of medication in you and you have been up there a long time, and have undergone a lot of pain and so forth, it's stressful. But I've always managed to apologize when I remember doing something I should not have done, or said something that was hurtful. And I still apologize for those. I still feel bad about those things.
Well, sometimes the anesthesia affects everybody differently. Even if you've had surgery before, you don't know how the next time you're going to wake up from it. Maybe your case was longer, you got more medicine, and your liver or your kidneys aren't functioning as well as they could be initially. It takes a little longer for everything to wear off. The CTICU is a very noisy place. It's a lot of alarms are going off. Yes. And it's not that things are going badly. They're just, the alarms are very tight so that we can monitor you really, really closely. And it's a really hard place to get sleep. So then you're in a little bit of pain, and as well as not having sleep, those combinations with that and the anesthesia kind of sets you up to do things that you may not normally do.
Yeah.
So we understand that.
Yeah, and you do, and you're right, and you do, and we thank you for that. Nurses, I've repeated this on many of my shows, but they're the most important connection between the patients and the entire healthcare system and also the entire world. So nurses have been heroes long before COVID came around. I think some of us didn't realize it until COVID, but I learned, of course, in my hospital stays, how heroic nurses are in helping patients get, they do most of the work during the day on their 12-hour shifts. And so
we're with you the most time, right?
You certainly are. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's never unforgotten. It's always unforgotten. That is, we never forget what the nurses did for us. I know I don't. I've spoken with people who have undergone heart transplants, of course, at this point, many, and most of them have had challenges, repeated hospital visits, further heart symptoms, etc. Does the transition to life again with a new heart go smoothly for anybody? I mean, is there always going to be some kind of compromise in the way their life goes, or can they get back to normal after they get a new heart?
Oh, you definitely can get back to normal, but you have to understand that everybody's coming into the surgery with multiple surgeries. Some people, this is their first heart surgery. Everybody's getting a different donor with their own history. Mm. So the outcome and a different surgeon, there's a lot of variables that go into the final outcome. But we have people after transplant that are running marathons, doing bike-a-thons with one of my transplant coordinators, did a bike-a-thon with one of my heart recipients.
Amazing.
It's just amazing. Yeah. And every time that heart goes from an ice bucket, to somebody's chest, and it actually works, it's just that never gets old. That's always just an amazing thing to see. You know, obviously we want everybody to have a good outcome or we wouldn't be doing this, but you know, it definitely works and works well. But the better you take care of the gift of that new life-saving organ, the better, you know, your whole overall post-op lifestyle can be.
Yeah, thank you.
But it's your job as a recipient to take care of that gift.
Yeah, to take care of that gift, right. You're getting a second life. And I should save it for the end, but we have a couple more things that I want to ask you about, Doreen. But I want to tell everybody who's listening to please consider signing off as being a donor, an organ donor, because we're opt-in here in this country and certainly in the Northeast especially. We have to sign off at the DMV. We're not happy to be at the DMV to begin with because they don't make it easy for us to fill out those forms up there for some reason most of the time. You know, I don't want to badmouth anybody at the DMV, but it's often a trying time up there. But that's when they ask you to sign off on whether you'll be a donor or not. So please consider. You can do it online too these days, but at the DMV, you have the opportunity to put on your license that you are an organ donor. So I would urge everybody to do that because you're going to save countless numbers of lives. So thank you for doing that. And one of the biggest problems that we have in this arena is that we don't have enough donors of kidneys, even living donors and hearts. So, and many other organs that we are able to transplant corneas and things like that, lungs. And so please sign off and please be a donor if you can. So with that, I'm going to shift gears a little bit. You've said that being on donor call was and continues to be your favorite role as a transplant nurse. What exactly is donor call? Can you just give us an idea of what that whole framework is?
Basically, you're just on call accepting heart offers from UNOS, United Network for Organ Sharing. They're in charge of the national waiting list. And then when one of your recipients, every transplant center's list is, you know, a varied number of patients, but every time you get an offer, you only have an hour or less to respond to it. Then you just, until you're primary, you just write up the offer and you speak with the cardiologist and the surgeon to make sure that that's the best suited match for your recipient.
Wow.
And if everything's a go when you're primary for the offer, because there could be people ahead of you that also want that heart, that's when things will move forward once you become primary. But you have to be ready to go at all times. So it's a long night usually, but it's worth it. And when you get that person on the phone, they're excited, you're excited.
Yeah.
And, you know, it never gets old.
Wow, that's amazing. And I was going to ask you as a sort of a final question, what has driven you after 36 years to keep wanting to be involved in heart failure nursing? I think you kind of answered it, but please go from there. What is it that drives you to keep wanting to do this?
I've always wanted to be a nurse since I was saved by a nurse when I was born. That's a whole nother story, but I've always worked mostly with cardiac-related roles, and I just love making that phone call and informing somebody that they have that possible second chance at life. And it's just so exciting. Everybody's, you know, that one organ donor, no matter how old you are, you can be a donor, can save up to eight, you know, there's eight solid organs because, you know, obviously you would only give one kidney at a time. And then you can save up to 50 to, they say up to 75 because now they're using nerves and bones and different donor tendons and graft, you know, well, there's so many different things that they're expanding the donor availability and uses. So it's really impacting so many different people now. And I'm really looking forward to hopefully continuing this just as being a donor coordinator with, you know, a private company. So that's what I'm trying to do right now.
You would be great for them. And thank you for doing the work you do. It's extraordinary. How interesting things that you've shared with me personally and with our listeners today. This has been a great honor to have you on as a guest on the Heart of the Matter. On behalf of myself and our listeners, I thank you so much for all you've done for me personally and for, you know, our community of people waiting for hearts and other organs and the global community, obviously, with your incredible dedication to your work. And certainly for sharing this time with us. I hope we can do this again soon.
Oh, me too. Thank you, Gary, for having me on.
This was great. Oh, we're definitely going to have you back. I still have many more questions. This is all hitting close to home for me, but mostly I'm doing this to share all this. So it's such an interesting information that we have available to us because of the special people working in this community, this global community like Doreen. So again, thank you. I appreciate it. We'll have you again. So that is our podcast for today. Please join me next time for another intriguing, informative, and entertaining conversation. Please visit our website at www.drheart2heart.net. That's D-R-H-E-A-R-T, the numeral 2, H-E-A-R-T.net for upcoming podcasts. Or if you'd like me to host an online presentation for your group or organization, if you'd like to be a guest on the Heart of the Matter podcast, please email me at theheartguyspeaks@gmail.com. Our podcast can be found on Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And I'll add a few more platforms if we need to, but you just have to search The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter. And until next time, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, The Heart Guy, wishing you peace and hope.